A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking, well, an enormous leap back in time. We're talking 3 million years, looking at the foundational 99% of the human story.
That's right. And our mission really is to get under the skin of prehistory, not just what our ancestors did, but how that huge, vast epoch fundamentally, you know, made us who we are.
And we're working with a pretty provocative idea here, aren't we?
We are. The central thesis is that prehistory wasn't just some static waiting room before history proper began with writing. It was dynamic. It was creative. It literally shaped our bodies, our societies, and, yeah, crucially, our brains.
So we're kind of tearing down that old wall between mind and matter.
Exactly. The traditional view is, you know, brilliant human mind comes first, then uses stuff. A rock, a stick, whatever. Passive tools.
But the work we're digging into today, mostly based on archaeologist Chris Gosden, it just flips that completely.
It really does. The story seems to be one of deep coevolution. Human consciousness, it didn't just pop into existence. It grew through this constant back and forth, this cycle with the things we made and the places we lived.
So the tools, the landscapes, even fire, they weren't just stage props.
Not at all. They were active partners in shaping what being human even means.
And for you listening, this isn't just, you know, dusty old history. Understanding this deep past, it gives you a really powerful new way to look at today.
Absolutely. If you grasp that our minds are constantly being shaped by the material world around us, well, that helps you analyze modern stuff much better.
Like the impact of our phones, maybe, or city design, or even why social inequality is so persistent.
Precisely. It offers a framework. So let's talk about the guide on this journey.
Right. Chris Gosden, he's professor of European archaeology at Oxford, and he was also a curator at the Pitt Rivers Museum, which is pretty legendary.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about him is he's not just stuck in one little niche. He builds bridges.
How so?
Well, he combines that hands-on, practical digging the fieldwork with these really big, ambitious theoretical ideas. He can look at a tiny piece of flint, maybe hundreds of thousands of years old, and then connect it to a grand theory about how human thinking developed across the entire globe. It's quite a skill.
And a Pitt Rivers background must be huge for him. That museum is all about material culture from everywhere. Objects are king there.
That's completely central, I think. It gave him this deep appreciation for what he calls the agency of objects.
Agency. Like objects having power.
Sort of, yeah. For Gosden, an artifact isn't just sitting there representing a past society. It's actively telling a story. It's shaping how people behave. It can even hold collective memory.
And he looks globally, not just Europe.
Critically important, yes. He pushes against a purely Eurocentric view. He wants a truly comparative approach that respects the sheer diversity of the human path. He's a deep thinker, really reframing the whole human journey.
Okay, let's get into the book's core idea then. The basic premise seems clear. If we want to understand ourselves now, our anxieties, conflicts, our tech obsession, we first need to understand the forces shaping us over, well, 3 million years.
And that means ditching those simple old school ideas about linear progress, right? That narrative of inevitable improvement.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Which brings us to this concept of material engagement theory.
Right. So the book argues that human cognition, consciousness, abstract thought, all that, it didn't just switch on fully formed inside our skulls.
Right.
Instead, it developed through this continuous loop, this cycle of making things, using things, and then crucially being physically and mentally reshaped by those very things.
So the intelligence doesn't come before the tool. The intelligence actually grows through the process of making and using the tool.
Exactly. That's the big shift in perspective. It's less like building a computer and more like, say, a limb evolving over time through use.
Okay, I think I'm getting that.
And the book demonstrates this across this epic timescale, starting way back 3.3 million years ago with the very first hominin ancestors making those first simple stone tools, the Oldowan tradition.
And it shows how just that simple repeated act kicked off this huge evolutionary cascade.
Yeah, a cascade that runs right through the migrations of Homo sapiens, the complexities of the Neolithic Revolution, the rise of early cities, all the way up.
And the point is to show how relevant that deep, deep past is for us right now, living in our complex world.
That's the ultimate goal, yes, to connect the deep past to the present.
Okay, let's dive into some of the evidence then, starting with what Gosden calls the very long beginning, this coevolution of hand and brain. You mentioned those earliest Oldowan tools. What exactly is napping? you use that term?
Good question. Napping sounds basic, but it's actually incredibly complex. It's hitting one stone, the hammer stone, against another, the core stone,
right,
at precisely the right angle with the right force to knock off a sharp flake. It's not just bashing rocks together. It takes real skill.
What kind of skill?
Well, you need predictive thinking, understanding how the stone will break. You need spatial reasoning, really fine motor control, precise timing, even a sort of intuitive physics.
So you're mentally picturing the inside of the stone, figuring out how the force will travel. That's amazing planning for early hominins like Homo habilis.
Absolutely. And the cognitive demands of doing that, the focus, the planning, the hand-eye coordination, it literally drove changes in the brain's wiring over generations.
And at the same time, the tool itself gave them something.
A huge advantage. That sharp flake could cut through hides, scrape meat off bones, crack bones for marrow. Suddenly, they have access to way more calories and protein,
which fuels brain growth.
Exactly. Better tools mean a better diet, which supports a bigger, more energy-hungry brain, which in turn allows for the development of even better tools. It's this amazing positive feedback loop lasting millions of years.
So being human is literally baked into this history of making things.
Pretty much, yeah. And Gosden applies this principle to other key technologies, too, like fire. He has this great line, fire didn't just cook our food, it cooked our minds.
Cooked our minds? What does that mean?
Well, beyond the obvious nutritional benefits, making food easier to digest, unlocking more calories fire fundamentally changed social life.
How so?
It created the hearth, a central gathering point. Suddenly, the active day didn't end at sunset. You had hours of relative safety and warmth around the fire.
For what? Storytelling?
For planning.
All of that. Social bonding, transmitting knowledge, developing culture, coordinating activities. It was a massive social and cognitive catalyst. Instead of just basic survival after dark, you have hours for complex interaction.
So a material technology fire directly enables more complex culture and maybe even consciousness itself.
That's the idea. It extended our minds into the night, you could say. Now, if fire helped connect us socially, the next big shift really changed our relationship with work and ownership. The Neolithic Revolution, farming.
And Gosden is critical of just calling it progress, right?
Yeah.
He uses the term Faustian bargain.
He does, because it was incredibly complex, full of trade-offs. Yes, farming allowed populations to grow massively, but the cost was huge.
Like what?
Intense, back-breaking, relentless labor compared to foraging. Much higher exposure to diseases because people were living closely together with animals and waste. And really significantly, the beginnings of deep social inequality.
How did farming lead to inequality?
Through concepts like permanent land ownership, surplus accumulation, inheritance, things that weren't really major factors for most mobile hunter-gatherers, Gosden talks about mutual domestication.
Yeah, domestication.
Yeah, humans domesticated wheat and cows, obviously. But in a very real sense, the demands of planting, harvesting, and storing that wheat or tending those herds, they domesticated us. Tied us to the land, changed our bodies, our social structures.
That's a powerful way to put it. And speaking of changing the narrative, we have to talk about Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. That site is just a bombshell, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely critical. It dates to around 9,500 BC. And it features these enormous, intricately carved stone pillars, monumental architecture, built by people who are still hunter-gatherers.
Which blows the old timeline apart.
Yeah.
The old idea was, first you get farming, then you get a food surplus. Then you can afford the labor to build big temples.
Exactly. Göbekli Tepe flips it. It suggests that complex ritual, large-scale social organization, and monumental building could happen before agriculture was widespread.
Maybe even driving the need for agriculture to feed the crowds gathering for these massive projects.
That's one major interpretation, yes. It shows that incredible creativity and social complexity weren't just byproducts of farming. Hunter-gatherers were capable of amazing things.
And this wasn't just happening in isolation, right? Gosden emphasizes connections.
Very much so. He argues that globalization isn't just a modern thing. It has really ancient roots. We find materials traveling vast distances thousands of years ago.
Like
obsidian, volcanic glass, traded hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles from its source. Lapis lazuli from Afghanistan showing up in Egypt or Mesopotamia. Shells from the Red Sea found far inland.
So prehistoric people weren't living in tiny isolated bubbles. They were connected.
Connected by surprisingly sophisticated networks of exchange, sharing materials, ideas, maybe even genes. The flow of stuff and knowledge is fundamental to the human story right from the start.
Okay, let's try and pull together some of the big aha moments from Gosden's work, the first key theme has to be this coevolution of humans and things.
Yes. Material culture isn't passive, it's an active agent. Think about, say, learning to navigate using a physical map versus just following a GPS voice. Relying solely on the GPS changes how your brain processes spatial information, right? Over deep time, the cognitive and physical demands of making and using something like a stone tool literally reshaped our hands, our bodies, and our brains. The tool wasn't just a result of intelligence, it was a driver of it.
Okay. Second theme, deep time and the foundation of identity. Just reminding ourselves 99% of our story is prehistory.
And that means our fundamental psychological makeup, our instincts for cooperation, maybe our tendencies towards tribalism, our creative impulses, our stress responses, these were all forged during that immense period.
So we're basically Pleistocene minds trying to navigate the internet age.
In many ways, yes. Understanding that deep history helps explain some of our modern behaviors and challenges.
Right. Theme three builds on the first one. The extended mind and distributed cognition.
This is so important. Gosden argues our intelligence isn't just locked inside our skulls. It actually extends out into the tools and symbols we use.
How does that work?
Material things act like cognitive aids, offloading memory or calculation. Think of a complex monument like Stonehenge. It wasn't just impressive architecture.
It was more.
It likely functioned as a kind of external memory system, a massive shared calendar maybe, encoding astronomical knowledge, marking seasons, structuring rituals and social life for a whole community. Their knowledge was partly in the stones.
That's fascinating. And the fourth theme, the diversity of social forms. Prehistory shows us other ways were possible.
Absolutely. You look at something like the Indus Valley civilization, large planned cities, but seemingly without the king's palaces or evidence of large-scale warfare you see in Mesopotamia or Egypt around the same time.
Or maybe more egalitarian hunter-gatherer groups that persisted for millennia.
Exactly. It proves that our current system's hierarchy, the nation-state, capitalism, that they aren't some inevitable endpoint of human nature. They're just some choices among a vast range of possibilities explored in the past. Prehistory is a library of social experiments.
The book itself has some really memorable ways of putting these ideas. Very quotable.
It does. The first one that really sticks is the idea that tools don't just extend our bodies, they extend our minds. That immediately reframes how you think about any technology, from a pencil to AI.
Yeah, that's powerful. Then there's the assessment of the agricultural revolution as a Faustian bargain.
Right. Trading the relative freedom, varied diet, and maybe egalitarianism of foraging for the relentless toil, disease, and inequality that came with farming. It forces you to question what we mean by civilization and progress.
Definitely makes you think. And the third one you mentioned.
That prehistory is a vast catalog of social experiments. This is incredibly liberating, I think.
Yeah.
It frees us from feeling like the way we live now is the only way humans can live. It opens up possibilities.
So how do we apply this deep knowledge to our lives today? Application one, critically reevaluating technology.
Well, if we accept this co-evolution idea, we have to stop seeing tech as just a neutral tool we choose to use or not use.
I have to ask how it's using us.
Kind of, yeah. How are smartphones actively reshaping our attention spans? How is constant connectivity changing social bonds? How might AI alter fundamental aspects of our thinking or memory? The framework demands we see the technology itself as an active force in our own evolution right now.
Okay. Application two, educational and therapeutic insights. If the hand-brain connection drove our intelligence.
It strongly suggests that learning is often most effective when it's hands-on, when it involves making, building, crafting, physically interacting with materials.
So less passive screen time, more making stuff.
Potentially, yes. Activities like shop class, pottery, coding where you build something tangible, even cooking complex meals, these engage those deep neurological pathways forged over millions of years. It might lead to deeper, more lasting learning than just absorbing abstract information.
Makes sense. And application three, informing the climate debate, how does prehistory help here?
Well, the archaeological and paleoclimate record is a huge database of how human societies responded to massive climate shifts in the past. The ice ages, warming periods, droughts.
We've been through a lot.
We have.
Yeah.
And the record shows examples of societies that collapsed because they couldn't adapt, but also incredible examples of resilience, migration, innovation, and long-term thinking that allowed others to thrive.
So it offers cautionary tales, but also maybe strategies.
Exactly. It underlines the need for flexibility, adaptability, and the kind of foresight that ancient societies sometimes demonstrated, planning across generations, not just election cycles.
Right. Okay, final thoughts. For me, the most surprising thing was definitely Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah.
Just that image of hunter-gatherers organizing this massive, sophisticated building project.
Yeah.
It completely overturns assumptions about creativity and social complexity needing farming first. It really expands your view of human potential way back then.
That's a great takeaway. For me, the lasting insight is maybe simpler but deeper. It's that this immense deep past, it isn't really past, it's not a foreign country.
How do you mean?
It's the literal foundation, the bedrock of our present reality. We are creatures shaped by that 3-million-year journey, forged by the constant interplay with the material world. And really getting that, acknowledging that legacy feels like the essential first step towards maybe a wiser future.
A future where we think more carefully about the things we make.
And how those things, in turn, are busy making us.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.